Hello, everyone. Thank you for checking in to another episode of The Naturalist Capitalist. This is your host, Reed Coverdale, as always. Before you do anything else, in the description, I've got a link to my Odyssey channel. If you will go subscribe to that, I also just dropped a link in the live chat. Please go subscribe to me there. I've got like 530 subscribers over there, so I've almost got more subscribers than there are members in Congress. That would be nice to at least beat that and then keep growing from there. But on the other end tonight, I've got Sal the Agorist, Sally Mayweather. How you doing tonight, man?
What's up, brother? How are you, man?
Good. So is it Sal? It's just Sal, or is what's your whole?
Yeah, it's just Sal. Sal works. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I think a lot of people here are familiar with you, but they probably mostly only know you as like a meme lord on Twitter. So how did you gain that? Like, what, how did that all start, and how did you end up becoming this famous Liberty memer that we all know?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess like, I don't know, a while ago I started just posting memes, and eventually I got a following, and I figured, well, I might as well use it to promote the sort of brand or the version of libertarianism that I believe in, which was agorism. So that's how I became Sal the Agorist.
All right. So where did you start? Like, were you always sort of libertarian, or was it Ron Paul, or what brought you into that way of thinking originally?
Dude, I was a raging neoconservative lunatic for most of my life. It was really bad. I'm really actually embarrassed when I look back at some of the arguments I used to make were really pathetic. But yeah, no, Ron Paul saved my life, man. I remember watching the debates and thinking to myself, all of the people on stage who I'm supposed to vote for, those people sound like lunatics. The only person who sounds normal is the one who I'm supposed to think is crazy. Let me look up this Ron Paul guy. And that's where I found, you know, it just led me down the rabbit hole. I found Walter Block and Peter Schiff. And next thing you know, I was buying Bitcoin and 3D printers and stuff like that. So yeah, Ron Paul definitely did it for me.
Yeah. So after Ron Paul, did you get politically involved in the Republican Party or the Libertarian Party or anything? Or did you just go straight to agorism from Ron Paul?
No, actually, I was in the Libertarian Party. And it was an absolute shit show. It was an absolute disaster. And this was back in like, I don't know, this is like early 2010, like 2012, 13, 14, 15, something like that. And it was just an absolute nightmare. I remember like I was running like their Twitter account for like, I think it was like the New Jersey Libertarian Party or something like that. And I had grown the following by like thousands of followers, and like their account was doing great. And then they just like, oh no, we're gonna have some old guy do it from now. And of course, like that's when everything just fell off. And I was like, yeah, this place is just not being run very well. And then I went to Porkfest, and I saw people were actually like trading for goods and services in Bitcoin and silver coins. And like, they were really living the libertarian life rather than just talking about it, right? Rather than, you know, just discussing it, people were actually living this lifestyle. And that's when I became involved with like agorism and stuff.
Yeah, that's a little bit similar to me, actually. I'm in the Libertarian Party right now, but in 2016, I voted for Gary Johnson, and I just was like so unimpressed with how the Libertarian Party was put together back then, and then how that campaign did. So I just like didn't pay attention to politics at all after that for a little while. And I just decided, you know what, I'm just going to stay out of debt, and I'm just going to become financially well off, and I'm just going to take care of people around me and try to learn things myself and try to actually live an independent lifestyle. And maybe that would be, you know, more inspiring to people, or at least more of an example to people than just posting stuff on Twitter or whatever. And now I've kind of like mixed them together, because I still live that way, but I've rejoined the Libertarian Party. But do you think that a lot of libertarians have that problem of not living the lifestyle, just preaching it, and then that might be a huge part
of
it?
Oh, for sure.
Anywhere.
That's the problem, I think, in my opinion. That's the premier problem with the liberty movement or liberty community, whatever you want to call it, is that people don't live that lifestyle. And if they did, I don't think we'd be in the dire straits that we're currently in, right? if people actually lived by the non-aggression principle rather than just talk about it or just theorize about it, then we wouldn't have to deal with any of this crap. I don't think these politicians could get away with all this stuff if everybody lived independently. I mean, just take one example. If everybody became their own bank and used cryptocurrency and gold and silver, that alone would sort of castrate the government, right? All of a sudden, the Federal Reserve would become like impotent and they wouldn't be able to fund the welfare warfare state. Just, and that's true of any sort of counter economic activity. Any way people can live free, that's the most revolutionary thing that someone can do.
Yeah, you know, I'm an atheist now, but I used to be a Christian, and I always thought it was interesting in the church seeing people who would just go on Sunday or, you know, just go for Easter and Christmas, and they would just kind of use the moniker of Christianity as some sort of like self-justification or like self-empowerment or like bragging right to other people. Right. And then you'd see the people who they really lived what the book says, and they were actually good people to their neighbors, and they actually cared about, you know, trying to reach other people and evangelize and give
true.
Up.
True. Yeah.
You see that in the liberty movement too. Like you see people,
right.
Libertarianism is just like a label that they want so they can brag to their friends or show off to other people like, oh yeah, well I'm a libertarian and I care about liberty. But then, you know, when they're not at an event or online, you look at them and there's really nothing spectacular or different about the way they live.
Or the new thing now is where they'll claim to be like libertarians and stuff like that, and then they'll go and promote like neocon positions or even worse, like, you know, left-wing progressive positions and stuff like that. So there's no shortage of that shit here in the movement. And these are the things that sort of retard us. These are the things that sort of take us back and hold us back. And that's why I get into trouble on Twitter, because I try to call people out when I see that shit, and then everybody gets mad at me.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of your altercations on Twitter when I was still there. And
yeah, that's right. You got booted.
Yeah, I got booted.
Do you have an alt?
I don't. Well, maybe I should just ask your opinion on this right now. I'm trying to decide if I should make an alt or if I shouldn't, like, because I mean, a lot of people that I know, like Ryan Dawson, Carrie Wedler, and then other people I don't know, like Alex Jones and, you know, a bunch of right wing people, like they all get kicked off of there. And so I don't know, like, I don't want to bring any more support to Twitter, but at the same time, it's a place where you can reach normies, you know, where like if you're on all these platforms like Odyssey or BitChute, or if you're on like Gab or something,
yeah,
like that, everyone who's there is already kind of maybe not awake, but they're at least like skeptical.
You're just sort of like yelling into an echo chamber at that point.
Yeah. So yeah. I don't know. Like, should I make an alt or what should I do?
Because dude, I would fuck them.
Yeah.
Fuck these people. I would. And just every time they delete, you just make another one, because, you know, they don't play by the rules. So why should we?
Yeah. No, I mean, no, it has nothing to do with their fucking rules. I don't care about that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I might, you know, like Andrew from Popular Liberty says, if there's a demand, there will be a supply. There does seem to be a demand for me to go back. So maybe that'll happen. But
you should.
Yeah. What I was getting at there is I've seen a lot of your back and forth on Twitter with people in the Mises Caucus, and I completely agree with what we were just talking about here with how LARPers are people who just, you know, go on Twitter and say all this libertarian shit and then they don't do anything in real life. Like, fuck those people, and, you know, get your own life together first before you start telling everyone else how to live, or, you know, trying to save the entire world from our foreign
right.
And we're like, yeah, come on, get off your ass and do something. But there are a lot of people like me, and then I'd say like Dave Smith, and people who actually have their shit together. And then just on top of that, we want some sort of outreach to get to the normies, just like with Twitter, like I'm talking about here. You know, if we have a libertarian party that isn't a complete shit show, that at least has some sort of strong messaging that gets across to people, is that a bad thing if, you know, if it's not just an excuse for people to live in an alternate reality? If you have people who are actually trying to change things on a daily basis, but also want to get the message out there to other people. Is there something wrong with that, or what do you think?
Well, I guess I would say, what sort of message, any message that the Libertarian Party can send must necessarily be sent through this sort of lens of statism, of politics. I don't think, here's the trouble with trying to use the party as like a platform, like to spread the message. It's, I call this educationalism, which is a term, of course, I borrowed from Konkin, but this is the sort of masquerading of the Libertarian Party as like an educational institution or as an institution of outreach. And I actually talk about this a little bit in my book, Anti-Politics. There's a chapter from Rothbard in there. And what Rothbard says is that these third parties are so small that they get branded as kooks. And what happens, and I'm just sort of really paraphrasing the whole chapter quickly here, but yeah, the whole philosophy goes down the tubes with them. And I think that that's true. And Rothbard says, you know, what sort of effect, the Socialist Party has been running presidential candidates for, you know, over 100 years now. What sort of educational effect have they had? None, right? And I think the same is true for the Libertarian Party. But I think that's sort of by design. It's difficult to spread the message of liberty from a political platform. And one of the things that I've gotten in trouble for saying is that spreading a message of freedom from a political platform is like spreading a message of chastity from a whorehouse. It's sort of like the same thing, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, you know, to me, the only way, and this is another thing I get in trouble for, because it's the only solution, is counter-economics, in my opinion. Everything else just sort of misses the mark, I think.
So what about running people as Republicans like Ron Paul did? Do you think that had any value, or do you think that was a waste of time too?
I think it was a great way to create libertarians, but I'm not really interested in creating libertarians. I'm much more interested in creating liberty. I think it's a noble goal. It's a worthy goal to try to convert people. I think this is what Per Bylund refers to as the savior complex, though. The idea that it's sort of this contradictory belief that libertarians hold, where we say, on one hand, we only believe in individuals, but yet we're trying to save the whole collective, right? We're trying to, you know, make the collective of society, we're trying to save them. And that's sort of contradictory. But Ron Paul was great. He saved me. I think, like, again, I think it's great to create libertarians, but not so much to create liberty. You know, consider the audit the Fed bill, right? If HR 24 or 1124, whatever it was, it died in the Senate. It was a great idea. It got nowhere.
Right.
Compare that with the success of Satoshi Nakamoto's white paper. Which one got us further towards independence from the Federal Reserve? I would argue that it's not even close, that the white paper did a lot more than that bill did.
Yeah, I mean, Ron Paul legislatively didn't really get anything done, right? I mean, if you look, I mean, I don't even know how many of his bills ended up passing, but the value of him was much more the public speaking platform, bringing attention to all the ideas. I mean, because he's probably the first guy that made me start thinking about it. And then by the time his son ran in 2015, 2016, I was actually primed and ready for it. And I jumped in with that. Like, if that hadn't happened, I don't know if I ever would have been aware of the political philosophy of libertarianism. You know, so I think like politics is almost, I mean, at least at the federal level, is entirely about your platform that you have to reach people. I mean, because like even, you know, Thomas Massey being the only Republican voting against the Iron Dome funding, that didn't stop the Iron Dome funding, but it was like, holy shit, look at this one Republican. And then that gives him, you know,
right,
platform to talk about foreign aid and everything. Or like when he stood against the CARES Act, it didn't stop the CARES Act, but it gave him this huge space to be like, hey, what the fuck are we doing, guys? Like, I mean, that's pretty much the entirety of the use of, you know, national politics at this point, I'd say.
Yeah, and notice how they'll allow one Ron Paul or one Thomas Massey, but never two, right? And that's sort of telling in and of itself. You know, the other thing too is you mentioned, like, I guess the Gary Johnson campaign in 2016, right? Well, Gary Johnson, this was the best any libertarian candidate ever did This was against two of the most unpopular candidates in history. It was the best NELP candidate ever did. He got like 3% of the vote. And that to me is like, that's telling. It doesn't work. You know, Gary Johnson was the sort of, go ahead.
Yeah, I just got it. Like, I don't think that like the Mises caucus has this false idea that we could win the presidency. I mean, I think they're like, a lot of problems that people have with libertarians is that they're delusional, that they're not being honest with themselves about the possibility of winning. Like, I think the Mises caucus is actually in general pretty honest about it. Like, we're not in it to win the presidency. It's like, just imagine.
I would argue that it's more utopian to think that they could create a nation full of Rothbardian libertarians than it is that they could make Dave Smith the president. It's just as much of a pipe dream that they could use a political party to spread a message of liberty that it is that they could actually take over the country. It's sort of like the Marlboro Man trying to teach you about pulmonary health. Right, you wouldn't take it seriously. And it's the same thing when someone, you know, stands up on the political stage and tries to tell you about freedom. It's like, what is this guy? Just after my taxes? You know what I mean? Like, it's just another one after my rights and my liberties. And I get the idea that Ron Paul, Dave Smith, and Gary Johnson, and like, it's true. It's a great way to, propagate libertarians. And I don't deny that at all. But, again, I'm much more interested in actually creating liberty than I am in creating libertarians. And I think it's a noble goal. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. It's just not my bag. It's not my cup of tea. You know what I mean? I'd rather life is too short. We only get like 80 years if we're lucky. I got a friend who's like sick and dying and like they're young and it's like, dude, I don't have time to convert other people. If you don't see, I mean, they are forcing injections on children right now. If you can't see the tyranny in that, there's nothing I can do to help you. I'm only interested at this point in making my life more free and more prosperous, you know? And that only comes through counter-economics and agorism. And I think the silver lining there is that it also creates a free society, right? That if we all practice counter-economics, you know, then we sort of get into Konkin's four phases of agorism and we get to an actual free society, like the actual agora, actual Ancapistan, if we all behave like this.
Yeah. So if libertarians would start getting on board with trying to progress with freedom, and if they also were trying to do it on a political level, as long as the political level isn't getting in the way of praxis, would you be okay with that? Is that like, would you just kind of leave them alone at that point? Or
I don't think it's possible. I think it's sort of a contradictory thing, right? I mean, think about the praxis there, right? How could you be spreading a message of liberty while you're also trying to attain a political office, right? It's sort of contradictory in and of itself. You know, with that being said, I'm not opposed to the idea of candidate A being better than candidate B, right? That's, of course, it's always the case. And we should always prefer the guy who's going to take less of our taxes and who's not going to, you know, be the guy who's less oppressive. I'm not saying that that's not the case. My point is that that's not going to get us to Ancapistan. It's not going to get us to the Agora. But of course, we should always prefer the guy who's not going to beat you up, or the guy who's going to beat you up less even. So, you know, that's completely true.
Yeah. So, is there any stage of tyranny where you would finally say, okay, we need some form of local government to stand up against this? Or do you think I already know the answer to this, but I'm just setting you up for it. So it's always counter economics. It's always agorism. That's always the solution, no matter how bad it gets. Or
yeah, local politics is even worse, in my opinion. I mean, like, what are you going to do by running for dog catcher? I mean, they're forcing injections on children. Like, you're not going to change shit by running for a school board. Like, we're past the point where your local mayor can solve this. We are $20 trillion in debt. Like, it's not going to work. The only way to win this game is to not play it, because the game is rigged, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, so is there an element of this that is just getting your brain used to the idea that I am free and I'm going to live like I'm free? Like, is
that's it.
One of the hardest parts to get by for most people, do you think?
That is the fucking key. I'm sorry, can I curse here? But that's the absolute key right there. That's the whole idea, is like, and that's the primary benefit of agorism. It's that once you accept it, it's like, that's it, you're free. There's no canvassing a neighborhood. There's no phone calls to make. There's no donations. There's no dues to pay. It's just like, as soon as you understand that you are free, then at that moment, then everything else ceases to become a problem. And like, they say, oh, but you know, if you do that, if you just live free, then you're going to get shot and killed. And that's what happens to the sovereign citizens, right? That's where they go wrong, is that they just live free openly and defiantly. Whereas we agorists prefer to use OPSEC. We prefer to be the gray man, to sort of blend into the shadows. Because if you are openly defiant, then you will get shot on the side of the road, like a lot of sovereign citizens do on YouTube. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's another point that I make in anti-politics. That's something that a lot of old school libertarian philosophers and anarchist philosophers try to get through to people, like Tolstoy, Thoreau, all of these guys, a lot of the older old school libertarian philosophers, the pre-Rothbardian philosophers. And nowadays, most of these libertarians don't even read that, those guys. So they don't even, you know, they've sort of thrown these values out.
Yeah, so you just moved from New York to Florida recently, right?
Jersey. I was like 5 or 10 minutes outside of de Blasio's tax plantation.
Oh, okay. So moving, is that still, would you consider that agorism, just by voting with your feet, moving somewhere that's better? Or is that retreating, or like admitting that the state actually does have power over you? I just think it's an interesting concept.
I think you're 100% right. It's not agorism. And a lot of people get mad at me for saying this, because like a lot of agorists that I'm friends with, and I respect, Jack Spirico, John Bush, a lot of people are like, get out of the cities, get out of the cities. And I think that that's true, but that's not agorism, right? Like agorism is black and gray market counter economics, and that's it. If you can move from a place that has a 60% income tax to a place that has a 40% income tax, you should do it. You'd be crazy not to. But let's not kid ourselves. That's not going to bring about the agora. That's not going to bring about Ancapistan. The only way to do that is to undermine these political parasites with voluntary exchange.
Mm-hmm. So isn't that admitting that the state does have power over you if you have to like escape somewhere that's really bad? Like, could you be a successful agorist in like Nazi Germany? I mean, is that even possible? Like, once the state reaches a certain level of totalitarianism, don't you eventually have to admit, like, okay, I might think your power over me is illegitimate, but it doesn't even matter because you've just become so bad and so overbearing that I can't even exist in your presence anymore?
Well, the state, so a couple things. I think, like, yes, I think they can become like extremely tyrannical. That there's no doubt about that. But I think there's always going to be counter-economic black market activity. Even in like the Soviet Union, again, there's a chapter in there. There's a few chapters in there about black market activity in the Soviet Union. But yeah, there was people openly defiant of Hitler. I have a chapter in the book called Rosenstrasse about people who were openly defiant against Hitler, and those were the only ones who were successful. They're the only people who are able to successfully resist the most despotic tyrants. Are not the ones who do it in some legislature. Those are the first people to go. The people who successfully resist them are the people who operate in the shadows. And I try to draw that out in the last section of this book. But the thing up here, and here's one of the incredible things about agorism that's sort of unique from all other versions of libertarianism. It's sort of a proof. You can actually use this as a proof. When we have a really despotic regime like the ones you're describing, all other political ideologies would seem to predict that there would be less entrepreneurial activity as the state grows increasingly despotic. We agorists don't think that. We think that actually entrepreneurial activity increases, and I think when you look at the numbers, you really see that. That's because the black market is the only truly free and anarchic market. Anybody who's out there listening, just Google Nalevo, NALEVO to check out the Soviet black markets and see how extensive they were. And some of the entrepreneurs, Konkin's book, Back Alley to Counter-Economics from the Back Alley to the Stars, does a good job listing out a lot of these entrepreneurs who, some of them died in, you know, gulags and stuff like that, but they were all wildly successful.
Yeah, what do you think about, there's a ton of conversation going on kind of between the post-libertarians and the libertarian, and I know they don't like to be called post-libertarians, so the Praxians and the libertarians right now about principles and how if your principles get you onto a boxcar in the end, then they're principles that you should reject. Do you agree with that, or do you think that you should be willing to die for your principles, or like what are your thoughts on that whole conversation that's happening right now?
Yeah, so I've been like, I tried to stay out of it because I just don't know enough about it to really form a strong opinion one way or the other. But I guess my initial suspicion is that it's true. I think that there is this sort of ridiculous dogma that we have to abandon that's sort of holding us back. But to me, that dogma is the belief in the political process. And I think in that regard, I think I'm sort of aligned with these Praxians or post-libertarians or whatever, but I disagree in the sense that that is a reason to abandon principle, or that's like some sort of reason to cede ground on the NAP. As far as I'm concerned, that's even more reason to uphold the NAP. That's even more reason that we should be abiding by the non-aggression principle, not less, right? It's if you're on a boxcar, that's because you're either using the wrong principles. If you were using the correct principle, then you wouldn't have wound up on the boxcar in the first place. That's the way I look at it.
Mm-hmm. So, what are the best ways that we can fight the state right now? Like, and you've mentioned Bitcoin. You think pulling your kids out of public school is a good idea? Probably homeschooling. What are the biggest things you can do these days?
Best thing you could do is to become your own bank. Stop using their currency, because as you know, we were talking about earlier, if they lose the ability to print money, they lose the ability to finance the welfare warfare state, and that's huge. You know, the three things I tell people is to be your own bank, get a 3D printer, and to grow your own food. And I think that if you can do those three things, you'll be better off than most of the population. You already see the food at the grocery stores are the shelves are starting to look a little bit more bare. I think that's going to increase every day. So everybody laughs at, of course, when we say grow your own food, but they're about to find out why we've been saying that. And of course, you know, cryptocurrency, that's huge. But the thing with 3D printers is it's not about making your own gun. It's the fact that it eliminates the ability for the state to enforce gun confiscation. If every home has a 3D printer on their desk, then really gun laws are just bad suggestions. In fact, all laws at that point become just bad ideas. So be your own bank, get a 3D printer, and grow your own food.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we're going to see a largely rural versus urban conflict taking place, I worded that wrong, but like there will be a lot of conflict in the urban areas but not in the rural areas? Do you think the rural areas are gonna have way more shit going down in the months to come, and that if you are in a rural area, even if you're not very independent, if you haven't become your own bank or if you haven't grown your own food, that it's still going to be easier to survive than if you're living in Boston or New York or Chicago? Do you think that's
for sure? There's we already saw the riots that was it last summer with George Floyd? I mean, even in Manhattan they were like throwing like bricks through windows and stuff like that. So it's like you're not safe in these cities. I mean, you a huge part of agorism is homesteading, and I really encourage that, because you know, one major aspect of counter-economics is creating local production facilities that bypass state regulations. And what better way to do that than in a homestead or just to be off-grid? So, yeah, I totally encourage that. And I'm in line with all the people who say get out of the cities. I have a difficult time seeing how that's going to lead to a free society. Do it, though, because it's best for you and your personal life to get out as soon as you can. I did, and it's one of the better decisions. I miss New York, but I don't miss like I miss like the old New York, like the gritty New York of like the 90s, not like Bill de Blasio's woke social justice bullshit, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think about the right and the left nowadays? I mean, I don't tend to think that in general, like if you look throughout recent history, that the right has been much more principled or low time preference than the left has. I just think like right now, the left has more power than the right has ever had. And so the reaction of the right is to sound better and sound more liberty oriented and sound less controlling and, you know, more like looking ahead to the future and thinking about consequences. But I mean, 20 years ago, the right was, you know, seizing all the power that they could at that time. I just feel like as the pendulum swings, the power gets greater and greater. And I think it's going to swing back. Like a lot of people are worried that we're going to become a communist country, but I'm actually more worried about fascism. I think the backlash to all this stupidity is going to be pretty severe. But what do you think? Like, is there a difference between the right and the left? Is one better than the other? Or are we just fucked?
I agree with you, man. I think that it's sort of like a pendulum, and we're going from like, hey, like if you notice, all the left wing presidents get more and more left, and all the right wing presidents get more and more right. And I think that that's a very sort of unstable situation. Eventually, that pendulum's going to fall over, right? So, and then all hell's going to break loose. Whether that's with like a left wing Bernie Sanders style dictator or like a right wing style Tom Cotton kind of dictator, who knows? But you know, that's coming. I couldn't agree with you more. It's the same shit. It's all the same shit. I don't care if it's like Elizabeth Warren or Tom Cotton, like as right or as left as you could possibly be. It's just different variants of statism. They don't disagree on socialism. They just disagree on what should be socialized. And that's sort of the whole, that's sort of the issue. And I can't stand when I see all these libertarians like pretend that the right is somehow better than the left or something like that, or that they're not the same thing. It's true. Candidate A can be better than candidate B. I'm not saying that, but my point here is that generally speaking, what we talk about as right and what we talk about as left, it's just the same shit. It's just, you know, are we going to socialize the welfare state or are we going to socialize the warfare state? And now they're sort of converging on just agreeing to pay for everything.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like, because you said they disagree what they want to socialize. Not even so much anymore. I mean, we're going to
offer
all the same stuff. And I mean, I don't even know what right wing and left wing mean in America anymore. They mean like, if you're right wing, you like Mr. Potato Head. If you're left wing, you want to get rid of them. And then aside from that, like everything is pretty much the same. Like even social issues, social programs, Republicans don't really want to get rid of any of them unless they're aiding illegal immigrants. And then the left doesn't really want to end any warfare programs. I mean, even like Bernie Sanders kept the F-35 program going in Vermont because it gave them jobs. Like the point, I really don't see a difference other than like the culture war. And I mean, I tend to agree with the right a little bit more on the culture war because the left is just fucking retarded right now. But like when it comes down to policy or philosophy, I think they're devoid of philosophy, both sides. So they just like, they're not thinking in any sort of, structured manner about how they should approach anything. So it's just like, oh, whatever, I like this. I don't like this. And they've become essentially the same thing.
You know, if you think about it, it's like, you know, in history, right? If you go back like to like ancient times, it would be like two sides like fighting for control and stuff like that. And eventually they just decide, well, rather than fight, let's establish some framework where we can agree on, you know, the transferring of power back and forth between us. And we'll call this agreement the Constitution. And now, you know, rather than fight and like violently, they just sort of, use the rules that they agreed upon in the Constitution. But that doesn't do you or I any good. So, you know, it's like you and I aren't party to that agreement. So we don't get to be part of the ruling class. And that's sort of the inherent issue here. And that's one of the problems with politics in general is that, you know, not to go backwards here, but you know, you sort of have to compromise regardless. Whoever the president is, if you elect a Democrat, there are some Democrats who aren't going to get what they want. If you elect a Republican, there are some Republicans who aren't going to get what they want. But the state always wins, and that's what fascism is. That's exactly what we have today. You know, you said you're worried about it coming to America. I think we already have it.
Oh yeah. No, there's no disagreement you there. Know. With fascism, I feel like this is a weakness for libertarians in many ways, because when you start mixing corporation and state, sometimes they think that what the government is forcing a company to do is a private business's right to choose what it wants to do. But then at the same time, you have other libertarians where a private business actually does want to choose what it wants to do. And then they say, well, because it aligns with what the state wants, then it is state action, essentially. And I don't think that's right. Like, I think that as the line between business and state becomes more blurry, we should be trying to separate them more. We shouldn't be saying, oh, well, you know what? The whole thing is the state. Because that's kind of what the communists do. I mean, and like, you basically handed them their argument, but I wanted to hear your thought on that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the way I see it is, it's true, a private business can do whatever the hell they want as long as they don't aggress on anyone. I agree with that. I don't like when they start towing the line for politicians.
Sure.
I mean, that's when it sort of becomes fascism. And to me, it's like, I don't support private businesses, you know, right to exclude people based on vaccine mandates only because it's mandated by politicians. So like, I'm opposed to the civil rights bill. So I think that you should be able to discriminate based on race. And of course, normal people wouldn't shop at someone's restaurant if they don't let, you know, black people or Jewish people there or whatever, and that they would go out of business. And I support the same thing in terms of vaccine mandates. The trouble is the state is the one forcing this on them. So it's not the fact that Chili's isn't making their workers get vaccine mandates. It's the government. They're just making Chili's into the cop. That's what they're doing. They're just turning the entrepreneur into their own police officer. If you saw that statement that In-N-Out put out, In-N-Out Burger, put out in regards to the mandate, they were like, their key complaint, their key concern was that they were being deputized, essentially, by the Biden administration to enforce these vaccine mandate. That's absurd. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be, I mean, it's like Jim Crow versus the Civil Rights Act. Like, I oppose the Civil Rights Act, but I do think Jim Crow is way worse. And if you were vehemently fighting against the Civil Rights Act while Jim Crow was still in place, it would be kind of weird. It's like there's sort of an order of operations that has to take place there. Like, once Jim Crow is gone, then opposing the Civil Rights Act is like, yeah, of course. Like, okay, I agree with freedom of association. But while the government is pushing so hard on businesses to enforce all this shit, if you're only speaking out against, you know, or if you're only speaking out for private businesses being allowed to make their own decisions while the government is forcing them to do all this stuff, you're kind of missing the bigger picture in general, I'd say.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree. You know, it's interesting. I completely agree with all of that. I just think, I don't know. It's sort of, I have trouble with the idea of allowing one sort of government distortion to you know, beget the next, right? We shouldn't allow one NAP violation to beget another NAP violation. And I think that is far too often the case. We have to be careful with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you can be principled on it, but it's just where you put the emphasis is kind of telling sometimes. I mean, like, if you, who's the guy that ran for president as a libertarian after Harry Brown? What was his name?
Wayne Allyn Root.
I'm thinking of a different name. 2000, was it the 2008 election? Maybe who ran as a libertarian in 2008?
I don't even know.
But whoever he was, I think it was 2004, actually, the one I'm thinking of. But Scott Horton was doing an episode with me once, and he was talking about how he was just going off about the Second Amendment and, you know, how important the Second Amendment was. And he wasn't really talking about the Patriot Act or the wars. And it was like, dude, come on. Like, you know, read the room, realize what's going on here. If you're going to focus on this stupid little thing, well, while George Bush, you know, like, he sunsetted the assault weapons ban or whatever, but then he's, you know, doing all this shit overseas. And
well, that's sort of, this is sort of the problem with politics in general, right? It's like Gary Johnson was a bake the cake kind of libertarian. So it's like, there's a lot of libertarians who don't agree with that. So a lot of libertarians had to sacrifice some principles in order to support Gary Johnson. Dave Smith is very strict on immigration. A lot of libertarians don't agree with that. So a lot of libertarians are going to have to swallow that in order to support him for president. So my point here is that you're never going to get a candidate who you agree with 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. In politics, you always have to sacrifice some of your beliefs, some of your principles, just a little bit for the good of the party or the good of the race or the country, God forbid, or, you know, something like that. And that's sort of one of the inherent problems.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't know. I mean, I have tendencies to agree with a lot of what you're saying. I mean, I've gone back and forth on a lot of this stuff, like, because like I said, after 2016, I was like, fuck federal politics. I don't care about it at all. And then I started realizing people only pay attention to federal politics. They have, I mean, even if you want to teach them about Bitcoin or counter economics or black market stuff, whatever, like, you almost have to teach it to them through some political campaign because that's all they ever fucking pay attention to. Like, if you're trying to tell them about anything else, like, hey, watch this video, read this book, like, they just don't give a fuck. They really only care about, like, and they don't even care about, like, governor races or senator races. It's just like, oh, who's running for president? What do they think? And that's, like, the only way you can ever hook people in.
Well, notice how I don't really necessarily agree with that. Notice how compare... Like, what is Dave Smith's main avenue of spreading the message? It's not the LP Mises Caucus. It's his podcasting, his stand-ups, right? It's entrepreneurship, right? That's how he does it. And I think the same is true of Scott Horton and Pete Quinones and all these different people in the movement. They do it. They're most effective not when they're engaging politically, but when they're engaging economically. And I think that's almost always the case, I think.
Yeah, but see, like, everyone I know, and including myself, who found out about Dave, it was through some presidential campaign. Like, I actually haven't known him that long. I found out about him through the Jacob Hornberger campaign last year. You know, and a lot of people found out about him through Ron Paul or, you know, some other politician. It tends to be, like, how you end up coming into this space. Like, yeah, I mean, I agree that their podcasts are great and they reach a lot of people, but for most people, if they're even interested in what we're talking about at all, or if they're going to come across it, it's because
that's true. That's true. But like, think about that. So like, a lot of people found Dave through Ron Paul. So in other words, Ron Paul, his effect isn't through legislation. His right. Real value is in, you know, is in the actions that he takes when he's not engaging politically, right? So like, his value here in this example is like spreading the message of like Dave Smith and like introducing people to him, not in creating bills and laws and stuff like that. So I think it sort of just reinforces that initial point. And well, it's no, true.
I'm in total agreement with you on legislation. Like, I mean, it took me a while to figure that out, but last year, like, with that, the final straw that broke the camel's back for me was that COVID relief bill they passed right before Christmas last year.
The Nancy Pelosi's heist.
Yeah, well, it was like 5,000 pages long, and like, I mean, obviously nobody could read it in 4 hours or whatever, and then only 57 people out of 538 voted against it. Like, after that, I was already fuck this.
Oh, no, I know.
I completely agree with you on that. Saying like, I'm actually agreeing with what you just said about Ron Paul being a messenger that brings attention to people like Dave Smith. Like, that's the only thing that I think a presidential race has any value for anymore. I mean, and I think that's what Dave's saying too. Like, I mean, maybe some people have to sell it a little differently, but I think everyone who actually wants that to happen, that's actually what they're envisioning. Like, oh, if Dave can be on Joe Rogan and he can be on, you know, Tim Pool and Dave Rubin and
Jimmy. He does that anyway. He does that now.
Yeah, but if you're running for president, it brings a whole different amount of attention to it. Like, nobody, like, most
think
people
about it. right now he goes on Rogan and he tells people about Rothbard and stuff like that, and it's great, and freedom, and how bad taxes are and how bad politicians are. What's he going to do? He's going to go on Rogan and tell everybody how bad politicians are, but hey, I'm also running for president, so don't forget to vote for me. Doesn't that sort of corrupt the whole message? Doesn't that sort of undermine his own the whole purpose of him being on Rogan in the first place, the whole reason we want him to be on these shows and stuff like that?
I don't know. I mean, I just have a different – I think you can be a principled person involved in politics. Like, I really think Ron Paul was pretty principled. I think Thomas Massey's pretty principled. Like, I don't think you have to sell out in order to be
– I agree. I don't think that they're unprincipled. I just think that it corrupts the message. Like, in other words, you know, again, I'm not sure what sort of any message that anyone receives through a politician or through politics must necessarily be filtered through the lens of politics. And that sort of, I think, always will always taint the message, you know, just a little bit.
Well, I wish more people thought the way you do, but I don't think they do, unfortunately. So, like, that's kind of why I think the political arena is an effective tool.
Fair enough. I do, you know, the other thing here too is I think, you know, we have a very limited amount of resources, right? The Republicans and the Democrats and the federal government, the Federal Reserve, obviously the military industrial complex, they have a lot more money than we do. So I don't understand a lot of these libertarians who think that we somehow have the luxury of wasting resources on, you know, these political campaigns, where I think, you know, instead of people donating their money to the Mises Caucus or the Libertarian Party or some other caucus or the Republican Party or something like that, put your money in Bitcoin, get a 3D printer, you know, become self-sufficient, get out of debt, do all these things for yourself so that you can. That's how we create more liberty. It's not by donating to the LP or something like that. It's not by pulling a lever. That's not going to create more liberty. It's about creating liberty for you and your life and for your loved ones.
Yeah, I guess where we disagree is that I don't think they're mutually exclusive. And I unfortunately think the only way to get more people to think that way is introducing them to your ideas through political parties or political elections. Like, unfortunately, that's the only, like, I mean, you know, I've had a lot of very interesting people on my podcast in over the last year and a half. No one in my family knows who any of them are. But if I tell them,
that, right.
You know, they knew who Joe Jorgensen was even. But they have no idea. They had no idea who Dave Smith was, no idea who Nick Gillespie was, no idea who Peter Schiff was. Like, they didn't know any of these people. But because Joe Jorgensen ran for president, they knew who she was. So, like, it just brings this extra magnetism of attention to whatever's going on. And I mean, trust me, dude, I wish people cared more about counter economics and freeing themselves and all the shit you're talking about. It's just, I realize people are fucking retarded and they don't care about any of this stuff unless someone who's running for president says, hey, pay attention to this. And then, I mean, that's how like almost all of us end up here in the first place anyway.
When you started off speaking, I had a counterpoint, but I lost it by the end. By the time you finished, I lost it.
That's good. That's good debating skills on my part. Yeah. You got any response other than that, though?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I would just I when we get off here, send me your address because I'm going to send you one of these because I think. I think this is where I really make my case the strongest is in anti-politics. And if I can't convince you here, maybe, you know, slowly over time, you know, once the Mises Caucus blocked me on Twitter, I decided I had to put this book together because I had to reach, you know, their members somehow. So that was the whole point. So yeah, anti-politics, shameless plug, anybody out there, check it out.
Yeah, no, I will definitely read that. And I mean, I don't think in principle on a lot of this stuff we disagree at all. It's just like, how do you bring it to the public and how do you change people's minds? And I know that that's a collectivist approach, but let's be honest, most people are collectivists right now. So like the best way to present something to all of them to get them to start thinking, because you and I, we can advance ourselves, and I'm not really worried about myself anymore, to be honest. And you might not be worried. I'm worried about other people at this point. So it's like, what do I do to try to snap them out of their trance and get them to start caring about stuff, you know?
So I just remember what I was going to say before. Right. you're talking about getting these ideas, you know, using politics to get these ideas adopted. Where I would argue that the only way that they're going to get adopted, these ideas of counter economics, is through economic incentive, right? So it's like, it's not, people aren't adopting Bitcoin because some politicians are talking about it. People are adopting Bitcoin because it makes sense economically for them. And I think that's how liberty is going to spread, through economic incentive. It's going to be by creating demand, demand for a lot of these counter economic goods and services. That's what's going to create liberty. It's not necessarily, especially when it comes to like education, right? Mm-hmm. Like politicians are opposed to these things. They're opposed to 3D printing. They're opposed to cryptography and look at Russ Ulbricht. They're opposed to Bitcoin and stuff like that. So the way to do it, the way to get people into freedom, is through economic incentive. That's what that's what incentivized Ross.
Yep.
It's what incentivized Cody Wilson. These guys were listening to politicians and thinking, oh, I better create a 3D printed gun. I think they were thinking to themselves, how can I secure freedom, you know, without going around these politicians, with making an end run around the state? And again, Ross got very wealthy by doing it. And I think, you know, as time goes on, more and more people are going to adopt cryptocurrency, for example, because it makes sense financially.
Yeah, I mean,
they don't have to know about the Federal Reserve. They don't have to know about that shit. It's wonderful. You and I know about it. We know that what them holding Bitcoin and using Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash or whatever, that is going to help bring about the collapse of the state. We know that, but they don't have to know that, right? It's who cares if they understand the concepts behind it? They just want to make money. They just want to protect themselves from inflation, and that's fine.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very fair counterpoint. And like I said in the beginning, I think both are good. Like if you can advance some sort of thing like Bitcoin or 3D printers or homesteading or whatever, and get people interested and make it take off, like, yeah, I think that's great. I just, through my experience, most people don't give a shit about anything unless they hear about it from because a lot of people know, they don't know shit about economics even, or about,
no,
you know, fact that they're going to be starving next year, possibly, if they live in Los Angeles. Like, they don't even know any of this shit. So they also don't even care about the incentives you're talking about, because there's no knowledge. So without knowledge, they can't, you know, they can't care about it. So I don't know. Like, I don't think we're mutually exclusive, even if you do. Like, I think that.
No, I don't think that, you know, agorism is sort of something that exists on a spectrum, and we're all, everybody is on that spectrum somewhere. It's just,
right,
you know, it doesn't mean that, you know, you can't be an agorist, you can't engage in the counter economy or anything like that. So no, I don't think that it's mutually exclusive at all. I just come down really heavy on one side and not at all on the other is the only thing.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Well, hey man, we're coming up on an hour. I'll let you give any plugs you want. You can plug your book again if you want. Tell us how we can get that and where we can keep up with what you're doing.
Yeah, Anti-Politics is the name of the book. It's on Amazon, ebook or paperback. I'm going to put out an audiobook or a hardcover soon. If you want to pay with crypto, shoot me a DM. Other than that, solidigorse.com, 3dprintergoburr.com. You can pay with crypto to avoid accessing KYC payment platforms, and Agora Threads for libertarian apparel and stuff like that. Of course, crypto is accepted. So,
all right. Well, thanks for coming on, man. That was a great conversation. We'll have to do this again. I've got a link to your Twitter in the description, so you guys can go find him there, and then all the other places he listed. And I don't know when I'll be streaming next, so just stay tuned. I'll be going on Olivia Rondo's show tomorrow night. But thank you for checking in, and thanks for talking, Sal.
Thanks, dude. Appreciate it.